Welcome to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, April 13th, 2014. The Reverend John Reed is preaching. Today's sermon is 24 Hours That Changed the World, The Torture and Humiliation of the King. Our gospel reading for today is Mark chapter 15, verses 15 through 20.
Second one comes from the Gospel of Mark, and it's chapter 15, and it's very, very different from the passage that Jennifer read just a few minutes ago. That, as I was talking with the children, that passage was all about celebration and the wonder of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, coming in what the people were hoping was a time to get rid of Rome, to celebrate, to go through a number of things. But this is also 5 days later, this passage in Mark. We've been going through this Lent. We've been going through the last 24 hours of Jesus' life. And we've looked from the Last Supper. We've gone to the garden with him. We've gone to the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas' house and the courtyard and the courtroom that was there. We've gone in with Pilate and listened to Jesus and Barabbas and Pilate. And today we are picking up right after that time when Pilate has released Barabbas and is ready to send Jesus off with the soldiers. Today's sermon is not necessarily going to be an uplifting sermon, because we're going to look at what happened to Jesus that morning. I'm not going to go into gory detail. I'm not going to go through and show pictures of what happens when someone is flogged in the midst of the flogging. I do have a picture of someone who was flogged and show the scars on their back after they were healed. But if any time, I'm going to talk about some things. And if it's uncomfortable for you, that's okay. I invite you can get up, you can go out, you can sit in fellowship hall. And I'm saying this because when Mel Gibson's movie came out a few years ago about the Passion of Christ, I went to go see that. And I already am fully aware of the suffering that Christ went through. I feel that deeply within myself. I'm one of the people that if you're watching the Olympics and someone falls, my gut clenches. I mean, I feel, just seeing other people being hurt, I feel the pain. And not everybody's like that, but some of us are. And I did not stay for all of Mel Gibson's movie because it was too much for me. It wasn't that I was denying what happened to Jesus. It wasn't that I didn't want to know what happened, but it was more than what I was willing to go through. And so I left the movie. Other people, you know, went through it, and so it's fine. So I don't know that anyone's going to be so moved by what I'm going to be saying that they're going to be so uncomfortable they'll want to leave, but I just want you to kind of know that this is not going to be a cheery, wonderful sermon as we go through, just so that you're aware of that. And hopefully now that I've said that, you'll come to me afterwards and say, well, that wasn't so bad, but we'll see. So picking up with the Gospel of Mark, with the 15th chapter, begin with verse 15 and read through verse 20. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed him over to be crucified. Then the soldiers led him into the courtyard of the palace, that is the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole cohort. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on him. And they began saluting him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They struck his head with a reed, spat upon him, and knelt down in homage to him. After mocking him, they stripped him of the purple cloak, put on his own clothes, and then they led him out to crucify him. Here ends the reading of the gospel passage. Will you pray with me? Almighty and gracious God, we've gathered together this day to worship you. We've gathered together to sing songs, to hear your word, and to meditate on a portion of that word. And so we ask now that the meditations of our hearts, the words of this mouth, that these will be pleasing and acceptable to thee, O Lord, our rock, our strength, and our redeemer. Amen. I'd mentioned that we've gone through these last 24 hours. We've gone through the Last Supper where Judas has just come in after agreeing to betray Jesus, to hand him over to the authorities. We come in where we see the disciples arguing who's the greatest, who's the one that's going to sit on Jesus' left and Jesus' right. Arguing with one another about position and status and power, and obviously not getting at all what Jesus had been teaching about, of caring for the poor, of the hungry, about the love, the grace, the forgiveness of God. The disciples getting caught up in the ways of this world, if you will. We go into the garden where Jesus is asking the disciples to stay with him, to be with him, and what do? They fall asleep. They can't stay awake. He's arrested, and we remember the scenes where the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, afraid of what Jesus might do, afraid of turning their whole world upside down, of twisting and turning what they had understood God to be, and Jesus bringing a new light into showing what God is really like, and it's not what they had thought, so they're afraid and they want to get rid of him. Afraid of losing power and status and authority. And Jesus, afraid to even stand up for Jesus and letting fear rule them. And Pilate last week, Pilate who had an opportunity to set Jesus free, but instead he decides he's not going to have anything to do with Jesus and doesn't see what goes through and keeps the power of Rome at the forefront. Status and power and authority were all he was concerned about. And we come today to Jesus where he's turned over to the soldiers. And before we go much further, we need to talk through about kind of what was going on here. Because we're talking about two stories here. We're talking about the story of Jesus, but we're also talking about the story of those who are watching and our story as well, the story of humanity, the story of who we are as human beings. We have to understand that as human beings, we say at times we're not perfect, and we know that, but we understand we are flawed. And we just need to look at history to see some of what happens with that. About 20 years ago, there was a horrible, horrible genocide in Rwanda. You remember that? Where the Hutus, one Sunday afternoon, after being in church with the Tutsis, I mean, these are people, two tribes, two people that lived together for years and years and years, went to church together. And one Sunday afternoon, the Hutus pick up their machetes and begin a 100-day killing spree of killing all the Tutsis they can find, hacking them to death. And in 100 days, 1 million Tutsis were massacred. Years later, an author went to go talk about what had happened, to look at that. And he talked with one of the prisoners that had been in prison, tried and imprisoned for the genocide. And he said, what was it? Why did you do that? What happened? And he goes, well, we didn't even see them as human beings. We saw them and kept deriding them at times, and over time we kept saying they were not worthless, they were horrible, and we began calling them cockroaches. And so when we went out and did that, we were just getting rid of cockroaches. And I say that because it shows a human condition. And we all say, how can that be? How can that happen? But we see it happen over and over. I mean, think back to World War II when the Jews were being taken off to concentration camps by the Nazis. And it happens there. And we see it take place. We look at the civil rights movement in our country and we see how inhumane people can be. We talk about inhumane treatment for other people, inhumane treatment for animals, but we can be more inhumane to people than anything else there is. If we're honest, we see that there's something that's not right within us as human beings. There's a flaw. We call it, in our theology, we call it sin, but there's a flaw that's there. And if we don't understand that, if we don't see that, we're going to miss completely what Palm Sunday, what Easter, what the crucifixion, what the resurrection, we're going to miss completely what all that is about. Adam Hamilton likens it to somebody who has cancer. A cancer that has a cure, but if you don't have the cure, it's terminal. Someone who has cancer and they don't recognize that. They don't want to admit they have cancer. There's a cure over here, and it's wonderful, and it can go through, and it can cure you of that. But because you don't admit you have cancer, because you don't recognize you have cancer, because you won't follow through and accept that, you deny it all, the cancer eats away at you and you're destroyed. All you need to do is go for the cure. And in our theology, that's what we're talking about Jesus is. Jesus is the antidote. Jesus is the cure for what happens, what is wrong at the flaw within humanity. It's Jesus Christ coming in to set things right within us. And this all takes place by the cross, by the willingness of Christ to come in. And we look at that, and I showed this with the kids, and this actually is, dimension-wise, is probably the smallest size of what the cross beam would be. It actually could have been more like a railroad tie. So you add in about another 4 inches on each side of this as you carry it through. And I can carry it, but I don't want to carry it more than down this aisle. I mean, this is a bunch of 2x4s put together. And this is, most of this, these down here are pine. The wood in the Holy Land was denser and thicker. You put the same thing like this into oak, and it's going to be a lot heavier, a lot denser to carry. But it's heavy. So imagine Jesus, who has been flogged, now having to carry this a third of a mile from the fortress down to Golgotha. And it's no wonder that he stumbled and he fell several times as he was going through. Well, let's put it back here. Let's back up a little bit too and think about the flogging. In Jewish law, you could not flog somebody more than 40 lashes because people could die from flogging. And early on in Deuteronomy, then it says if someone's going to be flogged, going to be whipped, the Jewish people put into law only 39 lashes because they didn't want to break that 40. They wanted to be sure they didn't go over it. And if you have heard or seen anybody that's been flogged, you can see some of the horrors that are there. But the Romans had it down to a science. They had two people, and they were called the lictors. Here's an aside for you. Remember the expression that someone took a licking? The Timex watch, it took a licking and kept on ticking? Well, the licking comes from the lictors. It comes from being whipped with the flog. Being flogged with the flogging whip itself. That's where the expression comes from. But anyway, the Roman whip had fish hooks, it had metal barbs, it had pieces of glass, it had a number of things that were designed to rip into the skin. The Romans weren't limited to just 40 lashes. They could have done as many as they wanted to. But the whole point of the flogging was not to kill the person, but to harm and injure, to humiliate, and even to cause more pain. The flogging would come in and it would rip the skin. It was designed also to go through and rip the muscle. And oftentimes it got down to the bone and ripped in and tore into the bone. So what happens is after the flogging goes through, it's not just simply your skin, but your back muscles are all torn apart, and you no longer have that much strength in your back. I couldn't pick this up without my back muscles. My back muscles give us strength. If I'm bending over, it's my back muscles that keep me up. The back muscles are extremely important in our life, and if you've been flogged and your back muscles have been shredded, it's amazing that Jesus could even pick this up and carry it down. But he did, at least a little ways, and then they brought Simon of Cyrene in to carry it the rest of the way. And they get him to Golgotha and they put him on the cross. And we come back again to this of why in the world would God do this? Why in the world would God allow the Son of God, Jesus, to experience the mocking, the humiliation of the Roman soldiers, of all that were gathered around. A cohort of Roman soldiers, about 200 of them. You had 200 men jeering Jesus in the center as they whipped him, as they put clothes on him, as they put a crown of thorns and rammed it onto his head, as they made fun of him, and cheering. It was bullying is what it was. Because isn't that what bullies do? You want to demean the person before you do anything. And a lot of times if you can hit them and hurt them, they're already susceptible. And I just want to show you how inferior and how small you are and how better we are. And that's what it is. And we see that all the time. I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands, but How many of us have bullied someone else in our lives? Same type of thing. Maybe not to the extent that the soldiers did, but we all have done things. So again, why in the world does God allow Jesus to go through this? Why does God submit himself to this humiliation, this pain, this agony, this horror? In theological circles, especially in the Western Church, we say it's because of atonement. Jeff, would you put the atonement up there? It's a word that English theologians made up as they were looking and going through things, and it comes out of at-one-ment. You have to remember, why were we created? We were created to be in communion with God, to be at one with God, to celebrate in the grace and the love and the wonder of God, to be with God, to be a family. But this flaw that's in humanity, this tendency to put down others, this flaw that allows sin to overrule us, sometimes whether it's be hatred or prejudice or bigotry or greed or envy, whatever it is that causes us to treat others less than human, treat others less valuable than who we are, as inferior to who we are, whatever that is, then creates a barrier. It breaks that connection. Families that have broken up or have had loved ones that have been caught up in addiction or destructive behaviors or alcoholism. Families that have loved ones that have gone down those paths and years later the loved one comes back. I remember when our daughter came back and into our lives sober for 6 weeks, and asking, can I come live with you? Fully expecting us to say no, because she had broken our family. She had broken our oneness together, and she knows and knew the pain, the hurt, and the heartache she had caused. And we said, of course, come home, come be with us. It's now been 11 years this December that she's been sober. And she finally feels, we felt fairly on that we were back together, but she finally feels she has atoned. She has done something to help us be at one again because she felt so guilty about what she had done. She came in, we showered her with love, she accepted that love. She showed us by some of the things she sacrificed in herself how much she cares for us, how sorry she was, and it welded and bonded ourselves, our family back together. She, in a sense, atoned for what had happened. She brought our family back to one. Well, we all did as we worked together. And that's what's happening with the cross with Jesus. God is working to bring us back to be one. And there's actually a number of ways that we interpret atonement. One is the substitutionary atonement, which is Jesus took on the punishment himself for punishment that we deserved. And I don't necessarily mean that we deserve to die because we've sinned, but I don't know about you, but I remember times in my life, things that I have done, and I feel I've never suffered or been punished nearly enough for what I should be because of things that I did. I know I've been forgiven, but boy, sure it was very easy. A colleague of mine shared a story about when he was in grade school. I think he said it was in fourth or fifth grade. And he went out in recess and saw a bunch of kids in a circle. And he went out and he joined the circle. And in the center of the circle was one of their classmates, a young girl who was a bit socially awkward. And they were teasing her and making fun of her and calling her names and catcalling and doing all sorts of things. And she was just in tears in the center of the circle. And he knew it was wrong. He knew it shouldn't be that way, but he didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. He just joined in with everybody else until the girl in tears wets herself and gets up and runs and breaks through the circle and runs out of the way. And he says, you know, no one ever punished me for that because no one knew I was part of it. And he says, it still haunts me. I still feel that I need to do something to make amends for that. He has no idea where this girl is now. He can't call her up and say, I want to apologize. But he feels, I wronged her. And I feel that something, I should be accountable to that. I should have a consequence for that. Well, if we talk a lot of time with parents now, we have those consequences to our kids' actions. And so we all know at times in our lives we have done things for which we need to be accountable. We need to have a consequence that maybe we've escaped. We all know that at times we have done things to belittle or hurt other people. And so there's that barrier, that sin against God, and we deserve a punishment of some kind. And the whole idea of the substitutionary atonement is Jesus took that punishment on himself so that we wouldn't need to. It would be like somebody volunteering to go down and taking the jail sentence of somebody who was convicted of a robbery or a murder and saying, I'll take the place to go through. It's that Jesus took that on for himself. And that's one way of looking at the atonement, that he solves that and breaks the barrier so that the Spirit of God can then come into us and renew us and transform us and change us and heal us. He can become truly that antidote for what's wrong with the human condition. That's why when we do our prayer of confession, we always have the assurance of grace. Because God forgives and renews and goes forward. Another view of the atonement is what we call the moral atonement. And the moral atonement is the idea that we know we have done something wrong, and eventually we know that something needs to be done. And along this line, it's kind of like going back again to World War II and the concentration camps. Germany started rounding up the Jews well before World War II started, and a lot of the Western European and the United States diplomats heard the stories. They knew what was going on, but they didn't believe them, didn't really see how that impacted them. It wasn't that big of a deal. And so it kept going and going and going. But then the same people at the end of World War II, when they saw the pictures of the living skeletons coming out of the camps, when they saw the mass graves, when they saw the lye pits, when they saw the gas cylinders and the gas chambers, it brought a huge uproar of how awful that was and how could we have let it happen. We go through and think about slavery in this country. And in our history books, we read about it, but we're kind of detached from it. And we know about the abolitionist movement. But one of the things about the abolitionist movement they kept running against was people didn't see how it affected their lives because it was down in the South, or some of them had been living in the South, and that was fine, but I didn't really have any slaves myself, and let the other person have what they want, and you know, we don't have any face to it. Until a man went down and took a picture. He'd heard about a slave who had been flogged almost to death, and he went down and took a picture of this man who had been healed and showing it. Jeff, would you show that picture? This is, I don't know how, but you can just see how scarred his back was. He almost died from the flogging. And when the man took that picture and started to show it around to people, it set fire to the abolitionist movement. Because people saw that and said, never again should that happen. Never again. Okay, Jeff. In 1955, a young Chicago man named Emmett Till, I think he was 15 years old, he lived in Chicago with his family, and he was going to go down to Mississippi to visit cousins. His uncle was a minister down there in Money, Mississippi. And he went down to visit them. And his mother kept telling him, it's different there than it is up here. It's different in the South. You need to understand how different it is. And he went down kind of thinking he knew what that was. And he went with his cousins to a grocery store. And it was owned and run by a white family. And his two cousins, also not getting how different Chicago was and how different Money, Mississippi was, dared him to whistle at the white lady, the owner of the store, to do a wolf whistle. Well, the boys never dreamed Emmett would do that because no black man in Mississippi would ever do that to a white woman. And they just figured he wouldn't do it. And they'd say, oh, you're a fraidy cat. Emmett, not knowing what it was like, up in Chicago, not seeing all that was there, said, oh, and so he whistled at the mother, at the woman. 3 days later, the woman's husband and his brother came and kidnapped Emmett from his uncle's house, beat him, strung him up in the barn, gouged his eyes out, and put a bullet through his head, tied a piece of farm equipment over around him, and threw him into the river. They found him 3 days later, and you can imagine what his body looked like. In the funeral, the uncle said, we're going to do a closed casket. And the mother said, no, we are not. We're going to have an open casket. The world is going to see what happened. And many, if not most, historians and civil rights people credit that picture, those images, with galvanizing the civil rights movement and getting it started, a kickstart to go forward to make a change in this world. Because people said, never again should this be allowed to happen. And that's the point of the moral aspect of atonement, is we see what happened to Christ, and we say, never again should such inhumanity be visited upon not just simply God, but upon anybody. And we see and recognize within ourselves we are flawed. We see that we could have been there, because I doubt I would have done much different than what Peter and the other people did when Jesus was there. I've been in crowds and kept my mouth quiet. But somehow when we see something, it shocks us so much, it galvanizes us, that we say, there is something wrong and it needs to be changed. There's something wrong with us as human beings. And we can't change it. We can't make it different. But Jesus Christ is the healer. Jesus Christ is the antidote. Jesus Christ is the one that can transform, can renew, can make whole. And so we recognize that inhumanity, and we come to God and say, we need forgiveness, we need grace, we need hope. And we bring God into our lives, we bring Christ into our lives, and we receive that. That costly grace, the grace of God that Jesus died so we could be made whole. So we could be at one with God once more and work with God to change the world one person at a time, to reach out in love and compassion and grace and forgiveness to those that are searching, that are seeking, that are in need of forgiveness and love and hope. That's what Holy Week and Easter are all about. It's not about pretty little Easter cards or Easter bonnets or Easter bunnies or flowers. It's about atonement and redemption. Not just for us, but for the world. That Christ came and lived and died, and we know rose, that we could be at one with God, that we could be healed, we could be transformed, that we could be changed and go forward to help change this world for the better. Amen.
You have been listening to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Community Presbyterian Church and its ministries, come visit us at 2800 Georgia Street in Vallejo, California, or visit our website, cpcvallejo.org. You can also email us at cpcvallejo@sbcglobal.net. Have a blessed day.